From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Every word has its story, usually hidden, says our guest tonight, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg. Shake a word until its top pops, he says, and you may well find a revelation, not least in a time of terrorism and a White House that frames the world in good and evil. Tonight on Point, Jeffrey Nunberg on the language of war, politics, and life in the Bush years. First, to Baghdad, the president of the Iraqi Governing Council, Izzeddin Salim, was killed this morning in a suicide bombing at a checkpoint near the American-patrolled Green Zone in Baghdad. He was the second member of the Iraqi Governing Council to be killed. Rod Norland is Baghdad bureau chief for Newsweek. I asked him what the U.S. and Iraqi responses to the killing have been.
I think U.S. officials are very alarmed because he was the president. It got pretty big press, and of course, it's the second time that a governing council member was killed. It's the fourth time now that Iraqis have been killed while waiting to get in one of the gates of the Green Zone. And I think they're very frustrated. There's just nothing they can do about that problem as they see it. They're searching every car. It's a long, slow, and tedious process, hundreds of people coming in. And because they need security officials like that traveling convoys, it's easy to spot them, and it's just really hard to stop a suicide bomber. Iraqis, on the other hand, are even angrier. I mean, everything that goes wrong is, of course, the fault of the occupation authorities. And there's a lot of anger still over the Abu Ghraib, the prisoner abuse scandal. And I think their attitude is they abuse us in prison and they don't care about protecting even their friends. And Iraqis all point out that American military vehicles and contractors' vehicles go right in the gates without being stopped and searched. But even governing council members have to go through this very tedious process. It's a little bit unfair because they actually get better treatment than some other civilians do in terms of getting in. But that's the way people respond to it.
Rod, Mr. Salim was a writer, a philosopher, editor of several newspapers and magazines from the southern city of Basra and seen as a moderate on the governing council. He was, of course, president, but that rotates every month, so there's always a new president, and he's described as a fairly low-profile council member. Does this seem to have been targeted, or was he just the unlucky one whose car was next to the bomber's car?
It might have just been that. I'm sure he was targeted in the sense that anybody traveling in a convoy of bodyguards in big SUVs, which is what they were in, is probably some sort of official or somebody important. So it might have been as simple as that. In that same line of people waiting to get in, we hear Adnan Pachachi, who's one of the most prominent members of the GC, and Ahmed Chalabi, of course, who's an American favorite, were also queuing up to get in. On the other hand, the insurgents have on many occasions shown very good, very up-to-date intelligence on the movement of their quarry, and they might well have known exactly who they're getting.
Has anyone in particular been fingered as the likely perpetrator of the explosion this morning?
No. At the briefing, General Kimmett, the official spokesman, suggested that it had the hallmarks of a Zarqawi operation, but you could say that, I suppose, of any suicide bombing. And the fact is that suicide bombings have been so frequent that it's no longer possible to just dismiss them as the work of outsiders from al-Qaeda. It's clear that at least a substantial portion of the suicide bombers driving these cars are Iraqis as well.
Rod, give us a sense of who's creating all of this conflict and insecurity in Iraq. We see a chart in the New York Times over the weekend which describes Iraq as having just a few thousand insurgents and a few hundred, maybe a thousand, foreign militants, terrorists, call them what you will. Is it such a small number keeping the whole country in such disarray?
Well, that's the official version. And frankly, I believe that too 6 months ago or even maybe 3 months ago. But I think now we have to accept that it's a very much a larger number than that. They have run too many operations. They're attacking coalition forces and anybody aligned with them and anybody working for them, something on the order of 50 or 70 times a day. You couldn't do that in a country this size with just a few thousand people. And they also have a growing number of sympathizers. And, of course, you know, sympathizers is what you need if you're going to be able to move around and plant your bombs and get intelligence and so on. I don't think that means that the majority or any large, even really large percentage of Iraqis want to see a return to the Ba'athists and the sort of regime that Saddam Hussein had. But it does mean that we have a very, very serious insurgency on our hands.
What does that say about the scheduled June 30th handover of some kind of sovereignty? If forces in Iraq now cannot keep these highest of officials secure, are we looking at a slaughter on the other side of June 30th?
No, because the other side of June 30th, Iraq will look exactly like it looked the day before in terms of U.S. forces and security forces. Nothing is going to change on that front very quickly. And it's simply a matter of giving formal sovereignty to a group of Iraqis who will then make the laws. But the police and the security functions will be either supervised by the Americans or directly in the hands of the American forces. We're not going to have one less troop on July 1st than we had on June 30th.
Big question, how on earth does Iraq get to some more stable security situation?
Well, the model that the Americans have laid out is a good one. They put an Iraqi government in place that hopefully will have more credibility with the Iraqi people, and they gradually try to train more and more Iraqi police and Iraqi soldiers and hand over things to them in a graduated way to prevent chaos and possibly civil war from breaking out. That sounds good, but it's all about the timetable and how, what kind of timetable they can manage to do that. And it's obviously going to take many, many months. The American military officials have been saying for some time now that it will be years. But there's also a lot of thinking recently that maybe it should be years, maybe it should be months, and we should try to accelerate that process as much as we can.
Rod Norland, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Rod Norland is Baghdad Bureau Chief for Newsweek. He spoke with me from Baghdad. In his new book, Going Nuclear, Jeffrey Dunberg takes his linguist scalpel to American language under George W. Bush. He looks at why the president uses the term nuclear and not nuclear, at why Americans now use the word freedom more often than liberty, at why the Iraq War, he says, is the most linguistically self-conscious war the United States has ever fought. In 1946, George Orwell famously wrote that political speech and writing are, quote, largely the defense of the indefensible. Jeff Dunberg has his own take, pulling miles of hidden meaning from the language of our time. This hour, On Point, the language of politics, war, and life in the Bush years with Jeffrey Dunberg. Do we live in a world packaged by the language of George W. Bush? What is the shape of that package? How do you hear the president's use of evil, faith, freedom, terror? Do you swoon for a man who says nuclear, or do you head the other way? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from San Francisco is Jeffrey Dunberg, senior researcher at the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. He contributes regular features on language to the New York Times and to NPR's Fresh Air. His new book is Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. Good evening and welcome, Jeffrey Dunberg.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Thanks so much for being on. We always enjoy your commentaries on NPR and reading you in the Times and elsewhere. Terrific to have this collection come out just now, when maybe we've never felt more wound up and bound up, surrounded with the language of George Bush and his time and everything that it means. You've probed right in at nuclear. First of all, Jeff, why nuclear in the mouth of the president?
Well, you know, I think it's an interesting word. It stands in a sense, for what the right has been able to do with the language. I mean, it's true that in a lot of people's mouths, that pronunciation, nuclear, is just a kind of mistake, what I think of as a typo. And it's just, it's not that it's really hard to say nuclear, but it's an unfamiliar word, and people think of it on the model of molecular and so on. And, you know, that's why Eisenhower said it. He came to the word late in life, and that's why Homer Simpson says it. But
a kind of typo,
case,
also a kind of regionalism. I mean, I think I grew up in the Midwest in an area where, in my memory, almost everybody said Washington and nuclear.
You know, people say that, but you actually, if you listen, you hear nuclear in New York, you hear it in the UK. I heard somebody at Jane's Weekly, the defense publication, saying it a while ago. You hear it in New Zealand. It's really quite broad now, that pronunciation, although people do tend to associate it with the Midwest or the South. But what's interesting to me isn't those people or that mistake. That's like saying February and so on. And I suppose one ought to say February, but it's pretty venial as sins go. But there are other people who say nuclear in a very deliberate way. And I think Bush is among that group. Bush, after all, somebody who grew up hearing the word used properly by his father, who says it right, around the table in Kennebunkport, then at Andover, then at Yale.
A table of Connecticut and Maine Yankees.
Right. If his father could say, and it no doubt if there was any dinner table in America where that word was liable to come up, it was George H.W. Bush.
Head of the CIA, right.
So my sense is that in Bush's mouth, it's kind of like that Texas accent he has, which is strangely absent in Jeb and his other brothers. It's this kind of what I call a faux Bubba pronunciation. Bush isn't the only one to pronounce it that way, I mean, for that reason. But it represents that kind of that way of assuming a populist attitude, even if you really aren't born to it.
I love the way you pop the top on words and phrases on this one. I mean, I think that the populist angle has got to be close to it, almost in the president's mouth, a kind of threat that comes with it. I mean, it's the way a kind of association with cowboy talk, or look, I'm a little bit Yehu and don't tempt me. Or certainly a kind of anti-intellectual, no pointy-headed nonsense going on here with this president.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. You're right on it. It's a kind of pointed anti-intellectual gesture that not just Bush, but a lot of you hear it from a lot of people in the Defense Department. There's a guy I went to college with. He went on and did a PhD, and now works. He's high up in a federal agency, and he says nuclear. And I talked to him. I said, "Well, what do you? How could you possibly pronounce the word that way? You've written this word 20,000 times in your life." He says, "Oh, it's fine for me." And I said, "Well, do you ever say nuclear medicine or nuclear family?" He said, "No, of course not." He says, "I only say nuclear when I'm talking about nukes." And I think there is a kind of gesture there to say, you know, we're the ones with our fingers on the button, and we'll call them whatever we damn well please.
Jeff Nunberg, you've pulled together a lot of columns and commentaries for this book, all of them, as I think I see here, from the years of the Bush administration. Is there a common theme to your linguist's ear to the way this White House, this president, this time have turned, bent, shaped the language?
Well, I think there's several themes, and they keep being repeated. One, for example, is the way in which the right has been very skillful at either appropriating or neutralizing the language of the left. So these words kind of are born on the left, they acquire a certain moral valence there, and then they're kind of taken over by the right, where they acquire a different sense. And this happens over and over and over again. It happened with empowerment, for example. It happens with discrimination. Now the administration talking about the faith-based initiatives program as a way of combating discrimination against people of faith. It happened with bias, which, after all, is a word that it's an old word in English, but it acquired its modern sense in connection with the civil rights movement, and then is taken over, particularly by the right, to make this point about the liberal bias of the press. You hear it with a phrase like hate speech, which the Republican National Committee has been using to describe not speech that turns on categories of gender and class and race and so on and so forth, but just speech that expresses an antipathy for George Bush.
So take the kind of crusading, to use another briefly used Bush word, language of the left and put it in the service of the right.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly what happens here. These words acquire a certain powerful moral valence on the left, and the right has been very sensitive to that. It's been able to appropriate these words. You think of the way a word like colorblind is used by the right now, which really is trying in a sense to
blow
drape
affirmative action out of the water.
Right, but with a word like colorblind, and with words like reverse discrimination and so on and so forth.
Which used to work the other way. Jeffrey Nunberg, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight with linguist Jeffrey Nunberg. His new book is Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. You can join us. Do we live in a world packaged by the language of George W. Bush? What is the shape of the package? What themes run through the language of the Bush years? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the language of politics, war, and life in the Bush years, the years of George W., with linguist Jeffrey Nunberg. His new book is Going Nuclear: Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. You can join our conversation tonight. Do you feel inspired or strong-armed by the linguistics of the Bush White House? Do you swoon for a man who says nuclear? What about evil, faith, freedom, terror? What words, what phrases do you associate with the Bush years? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Let's invite the president in for just a moment, just to have his voice, his language, his cadence with us. This is George Bush from his weekly radio address this past Saturday, reacting to the beheading of American Nicholas Berg.
The terrorists rejoice in the killing of the innocent and have promised similar violence against Americans, against all free peoples, and against any Muslims who reject their ideology of murder. Their barbarism cannot be appeased, and their hatred cannot be satisfied. There is only one way to deal with terror. We must confront the enemy and stay on the offensive until these killers are defeated.
President Bush, last Saturday, Jeff Nunberg, I don't know if you heard that when it was delivered, but you get the sense pretty quickly there, and I wonder how your linguist's ear grabs on to the president when he's in that mode. He's going against barbarism, appeasement, killers will be defeated.
Yeah, and those are all code words, I mean, or words that are kind of saturated with a certain moral import without really having a lot of content to them. And what's unfortunate, I mean, these are things like the killing, the beheading, that these awful things that upset all of us, but there's a way in which they're wrapped in this language and imported as a justification for a whole series of policies and so on that they perhaps don't lead to. So phrases like the ideology of murder or terror is an interesting word, the way it's been used. Clearly, Al-Qaeda is a terrorist organization, mm-hmm. but the word is used now, particularly just as terror rather than terrorism, mm-hmm. just to describe anybody who finds himself on the wrong side from the U.S. in one or another engagement.
Is George W. Bush different than other presidents in the way he uses the language? I mean, presumably all presidents attempt to use the language to shape the way Americans see the world, to draw support for their policies, to give momentum to their agendas.
You know, I think Bush is, in a certain sense, to call Bush a skillful user of the language will seem an odd thing, but I think he is rather skillful. I think he's, on the one hand, managed to neutralize the effect that his malaprops and ungrammaticalities originally had on the American public. Some people regarded it as unfortunate. A lot of people just found it reasonable and in fact, kind of folksy. And I think the single-mindedness with which he uses these expressions, which he says, you see, terrorists hate freedom, mm-hmm. that reduce, or the use of evil, that reduce everything to a kind of single-minded theme, is very effective. He's not a man of different shades of gray. It's all black and white, and he's relentless in being able to do that linguistically.
I'm particularly interested in what you made of the kind of a cascade of adjectives that came in the aftermath of revelations about the prisoner abuses at Abu Ghraib. There was a kind of, you know, softer words at first and then harder and harder, maybe going into territory where this administration didn't really want to go. Disgust, abhorrent, cruelty, humiliation, these from George Bush. How did you listen to the way the president began to comment on those images that everyone was looking at and then sort of ratcheted up his language as the images became worse and more widespread?
You know, it's interesting. I think you're right. There was at first a kind of uncertainty about how to deal with it, and in part because the photographs didn't speak for themselves in a certain way. And you had, forgive me, you had on the one hand some people Rush Limbaugh used the word, and Midge Dekter used it as well, hazing.
Yeah,
to describe
comparing
what
it to fraternity hazing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to comparing to fraternity hazing as if these guys were in a position just to walk out, or if they, you know, submitted to this for a week, they'd get to be
called the dean
of the club and so on. Yeah, and that was a sort of grotesque way of thinking about it. But you're right. I mean, at first, people tried to downplay what had happened, and then as you say, these words like disgust and abhorrent and so on kept growing. Now, what's interesting is that if you look at the European press, the British press, the French press, the Italian press, and the German press, the papers on both sides, left and right, are just using the word torture for this. Torture scandal, torture in Iraq, mm-hmm. torture en Iraq, I mean, mm-hmm. in all of the papers. That's a word that the American press has stayed away from. And they've been, although condemning what happened, they've been reluctant to describe it as torture, abuse, mistreatment, maltreatment, and so on. Maybe because they're scared of being accused of playing the moral equivalence card, that is to say, of saying that this is no different from what Saddam Hussein did. Or maybe because torture for us is a kind of aestheticized ritual that we associate with some exotic cultures or exotic people. I mean, when you see torture in the movies, it's always a foreigner, you know, it's mm-hmm. Gert Frobe or it's Vincent Price, who's an American who looks like he's lived abroad for a long time. So there's a sense in which Americans have been reluctant to use what Rumsfeld called the torture word to describe it, as if there was in some sense, we were different from them.
And I wonder about that as you look at general American usage. I guess this would be particularly in the media over these last words. Is there a way in which the White House, the Bush kind of lexicon or vernacular, has boxed American writers, American journalists, off from certain words? Is there a sense in which the president's language kind of drags a foot out the carriage of the country's dialogue, you know, makes certain words off limits, out of bounds, or out of tune with the music from the White House?
What sorts of words are you thinking of?
Torture is a good example. You said the American mm-hmm. media has been reluctant to use it. I don't know if you've seen other words that sort of have gone dim or blinked out or disappeared, gone into hunker down mode during this administration because they're not in tune with the way George Bush talks about the world.
Yeah, I certainly think there's a tendency, and I don't know that this is Bush per se, but there's a tendency because of the pressure that the right has been able to exert on the media with these constant charges of bias and so on. There's a kind of a reaction in the media. The media tends to pull back on itself, to be careful about what words use. And I think the example of failing to use the word torture, the utter absence of that word in the American press, as opposed to, as I say, the British press of both the left and the right, is a sign of how jumpy the American press has been become about this sort of thing.
Let's pull another thread of George Bush's language and focus into the conversation here. This is a bit of tape from George Bush on May 14th, delivering the commencement address at Concordia University, a Lutheran university in Wisconsin. And he spoke about the role that graduates of this religious college can play in American life.
Our Declaration of Independence calls life an endowment of the Creator, and on earth an unalienable right. Applying this belief has always been a test of our democracy. Your education has prepared you to add to these debates with respect for others and with confidence in your own beliefs. By your voice and by your example, all of you can help to build a culture of life in America.
A culture of life in America. The president went on to talk about the teaching of faith being confirmed in our daily experience. He said, our worth comes from bearing the image of our Maker. He said to the graduates, you have that power. If you follow this calling, you can help transform our society one heart, one soul at a time. This was a sort of new gusher of language, more religiously tinged than anything I can remember hearing from George Bush, Jeffrey Nunberg.
Bush has been, certainly evil is a word that Bush used to great effect after 9/11, and Bush has in general been very comfortable, I would say, using religious language and so on. Well, one of the interesting things about that phrase, culture of life, for example, is that as best I can tell, it was actually, whether it was coined or not, it was introduced into the discourse by the Pope back around 1992, 1993. He used it in several speeches. When he made a trip in 93 to the States in Denver, he used that culture of life phrase, and it caught on very widely and was picked up not just, I mean, it was again, because of the abortion debates, picked up by evangelicals as well as by Catholics, and has become a very effective kind of rhetoric for the anti-abortion forces who were perceived perhaps 15 or 20 years ago as extremists that made people very nervous. Now phrases like the culture of life have been very successful for them, I think.
And not to mention transforming our society one soul at a time, and our worth comes from bearing the image of our Maker. I mean, these are riding a fence here. They're right on some kind of line. It's hard for me to define, but one soul at a time. This is the very thinly veiled language of evangelicals that George Bush is proudly a part of, and a lot of Americans will respond to that, yet I don't recall hearing that in the mouths of his predecessors.
No, I think you'd have to go by, I don't know, William Jennings Bryan or some late 19th century politician to find that kind of religiously inspired rhetoric. But Bush comes by it very naturally. You know, in a funny way, it's very effective for him because on the one hand, it reassures the base, as they say. And on the other hand, it hasn't really turned off the voters in the center, the swing voters in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania and so on, who often have many of those values.
Well, it's very carefully burnished to ride somewhere
right.
in between.
Right.
Let's invite our callers in. A lot of them are waiting. Martin's joining us from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Martin. You're on the air.
Oh, great. I want to focus specifically on the word nuclear.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if the distortion of the word into nuclear is perhaps a deliberate way to make it sound more threatening. Nuke you. In a subliminal way, perhaps.
Well, yeah. Jeff Dunbar.
There may be something of that, the association of nuclear and nukes. And certainly there are two kinds of people who say nuclear, one of whom says it for everything, nuclear family, nuclear medicine, and so on. Another of whom says it only for weapons. And in that case, there may very well be an association between nuclear and nukes.
But I have to say, Martin, I hear what you're hearing there when you pull it into that more, deep vernacular, slangy usage. It takes a kind of formality away that says I can pull this thing from my holster. Thanks for calling, Martin. Jeff Dunberg, you write interestingly about the way the American military names its campaigns and how that has evolved over the years, how they started out rather neutral years ago, and now every time we have a new initiative, it's got a big and very carefully crafted name to go with it. This also strikes me. I know it's not brand new, but somehow this Bush administration, seems to have used this with more depth and consistency than any I remember before.
Well, it's actually something that began, it depends, you know, you can date it in various ways. During the Second World War, most operations names, particularly the military operations names, were chosen with an eye toward being as nondescript and as possible in the hope that they wouldn't disclose anything about the nature of the operation. In fact, Churchill made a point of saying we shouldn't name give operations names like Operation Victory, or he warned against using words that implied an overconfident sentiment, lest you might have to then notify the next of kin of some soldier who'd been killed in the operation that he was killed in Operation Victory.
So they had Market Garden in Mulberry.
Market Garden, Mulberry, Overlord had a certain rhetorical ring, but I think mostly
the D-Day
the fact.
Code.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it really wasn't until, though, there were, the operations in Vietnam tended to have names like N-Sweep and Pocket Money and Abilene. It really wasn't until Bush's father, that people began to use these operation names in a very deliberate way and as a kind of PR program. The operation in Panama what was that, 1989, was called Operation Just Cause.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first of these. And after that, there were a whole bunch of them. Restore Hope in Somalia, Uphold Democracy was the name of the operation. in Haiti, determine force, provide promise. There have been a lot of these provide things, provide promise, provide relief, and so on. So it was really Bush's father who got that going and who made the operation names invested the operation names with a kind of justification, knowing that the newscasters would start talking about Operation Just Cause and Operation
more recently, Operation Enduring Freedom.
Enduring Freedom.
Bush W.
Right. Enduring Freedom I always worried about because I wasn't sure if it meant that it was freedom that endured or freedom that had to be endured. But those names were picked up by the newscasters. In a certain sense, they do a lot of the PR for the military or for the administration. The problem is that if you pick these overconfident, grand-sounding names, and then the operation doesn't work out, you're stuck with one of these unfortunate historical ironies.
With egg on your face. Marika's calling from Beverly, Massachusetts. Hi, Marika. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for letting me come on here. I know I'm from very liberal Massachusetts, and we are not big fans of Bush for many reasons, but I think it's the way he massacres the English language that drives me the most insane. I was just talking to Tay about his use of the word suiciders during one of his State of the Union addresses. And then, of course, there's his favorite word, which one time I counted was freedom, because that's all I can do when I listen to the State of the Union address. There is nothing that he says. There's no meaning. But I think he used it 13 times in the span of 10 minutes.
Marika, the music of that may be missing you, but you've got to acknowledge that it's worked quite well until Iraq got so difficult for George Bush. He's had pretty good poll numbers.
Yeah. And it makes me wonder how eloquent the average American actually is then, or at least articulate.
Or if they're looking for eloquence. Marika, thanks for your call. Jeffrey Number, what about that? George Bush is anti-eloquence, and for quite a while it seems to have worked pretty well for him.
Yeah, no, I don't really mind Bush's malaprops and so on so much. I mean, Eisenhower did it and took a lot of flack for it, and Harding before him and so on. And the malaprops by themselves don't bother me, but the use of words like freedom, I think, is much more interesting and significant. It's actually, there's a piece in the I did in this book about freedom and liberty, and the way that freedom has slowly, over the course of the last century, displaced liberty in the American lexicon. During the First World War, we fought for liberty. There were liberty ships and liberty dogs and liberty cabbage and liberty buttons, and people bought liberty bonds and so on. And freedom originally is another word that actually the left had a lot to do with spreading in the discourse. Roosevelt had a lot to do with it. But Reagan was the figure who understood the power of the word freedom. He used it in his second inaugural address something like 14 times and used liberty only once. And freedom now has this very broad general sense that expands beyond the merely political meaning of liberty.
And maybe a less systematic meaning of liberty. We'll come back and pick that up. Jeffrey Nunberg, please stand by. Jeffrey Nunberg's new book is Going Nuclear. We're talking about the language of politics, war, and life in the Bush years tonight. You can join us. Is George W. Bush imposing a lexicon on the country or tapping the nation's natural language? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the language of politics, war, and life in the Bush years, the years of George W. Bush, with Jeffrey Nunberg. He is professor of linguistics at Stanford. You know him from NPR's Fresh Air and his columns in the New York Times. His new book is Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. You can join our conversation. What words, what phrases do you associate with the George W. Bush years? What words are missing from the Bush years? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Chris is calling from Boston. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. Listen, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First, I'd like to congratulate you guys for having discovered political rhetoric, and I look forward to the chapter of the program that discovers public relations and its influence on politics.
Oh, well, thanks so much for giving us that pioneering status, Chris.
But let me just ask you, you know, when I hear the analysis of why the president says nuclear and the definitiveness of the answer that it's anti-intellectual, why do I say good afternoon? Or, for that matter, why did John Kennedy say good afternoon?
Are you suggesting in your question that it's the opposite?
No, I asked you why President Kennedy said good afternoon.
Jeff Lundberg, my linguist friend?
You are the linguistic experts, or at least one of you is. So, I mean, when
I say good afternoon,
when I say ask, I'm saying something very particular, am I not?
Jeff Lundberg.
You are saying something very particular, and I assume you come from that a part of the world where that's
just... Am I saying that for a political reason, or am I
No more than, you know, I as a New Yorker, I say bad.
Call in who says quite seriously that nuclear means nuke you, and you actually chatter on about it in a serious fashion, doesn't that tend to question the whole basis of the conversation?
But Chris, are you questioning the whole notion of linguistic analysis?
No, absolutely not. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Political rhetoric and public relations and its influence on politics is an age-old issue. The very idea that the president says something a certain way is an indication that he means it to be anti-intellectual. I ask you, what's the basis for that?
Well, it's an interesting question, whether Bush says it because he comes to it natively, the way many people do in many parts of the country, or whether it's a kind of affectation. And, you know, if I hear somebody using a certain pronunciation that's current in their part of the world, in their class or ethnic group or whatever, and it's just they're talking like everybody else they grew up around speaks, then I don't tend to assign it any particular significance. But when I hear somebody whose father says the word nuclear correctly and whose brothers say it correctly and who grew up in going to prep school in New England and then to Yale and so on and so forth, and then who winds up in West Texas with a very strong West Texas accent that none of his brothers have acquired, then I start to think, well, this is the kind of thing that everybody does in a certain way, a certain, you can call it an affectation, you can call it a kind of populist rhetoric, but it's in one way or another a choice. It's not something he grew up speaking and never thought about at any point and never made any deliberate decision about. And when somebody makes a choice about language, whether it's a question of how to pronounce the word nuclear, or how to use the word freedom, or how to use when to use religious expressions like culture, life, then you say, well, that's significant, and we can talk about that as a kind of political rhetoric.
Jeffrey Nunberg, I suppose Chris is right in raising the idea that all presidents in this media age have to be aware of how they present. They get a lot of feedback from very professional handlers on how they present. They must... You know, I guess they use their language... you know, to whatever they perceive is their advantage.
Yeah, that's for sure. Although my sense is that the handlers and the consultants and so on can only do so much. And interestingly, people who are particularly effective communicators, like Clinton or like Reagan, are people who learn these tricks early on. I don't think they're things that you can learn later in life. Kerry has a stilted manner. He's not certainly an effective communicator of warmth or human contact. I'm sure that he's working with consultants right now who are trying to help him with that. But I don't think it's something you can just acquire later in life.
It seems to me, if memory serves, that Jimmy Carter also said nuclear, and he was a nuclear engineer.
Yeah, Carter actually said nuclear, as best I can hear it, which really was a kind of Georgia pronunciation that didn't have any particular political or rhetorical significance. Clinton went back and forth. He said both. Les Aspin said nuclear. There's a Defense Department Pentagon way of pronouncing that word, particularly among people who use the word a lot and who have to do with the things. And in their case, of course, they know how the word should be pronounced. It's a deliberate choice.
And a culture, I guess. Chris, thanks for your call. Steve is calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Well,
a couple times in the course of this conversation, I've heard you say that I've heard you characterize George Bush as being very effective in the way that he speaks. But I think you need to frame that in what he's effective at doing. If you are saying that he's effective in keeping his poll numbers up and getting reelected, hopefully not, but getting reelected, then perhaps that's legitimate. But I would think that he's incredibly ineffective when he does something like goes on Arab television and uses the word must repeatedly, speaking to an Arab population, saying the people of the Arab world must understand this about America and must understand that about America, And all I can hear is the damage that he's doing by that.
Was this his speech?
I don't consider that to be effectiveness at all.
Steve, was this his speech where he tried to reassure the Arab world that the United States would go after the people who had perpetrated Abu Ghraib abuses?
Six or seven days ago when he was appearing on the Arab channels.
I don't know, Jeffrey Nunberg, if you pick up issues of translation and cross-cultural presidential communication, but how about it on the must?
Well, certainly on that must, and let me say that I agree. When I say effective, I mean effective in preserving the base and keeping his poll numbers up and so forth. I don't mean that he's effective at communicating a vision that, all Americans can sign on for, and certainly not effective in explaining the American position to either to adversaries or people in the middle or even traditional allies like the Europeans. I mean, he's been linguistically a catastrophe in that regard. And with regard to the way he communicates in particular to the Arab world, there have been a lot of disasters, beginning with that that use of crusade early on that Tom mentioned, where I mean, crusade is this word, you know, we think a crusader is a crusader rabbit or a crusader tank, or Ralph Nader is a crusader for consumer rights and so on and so forth. The word, we no longer connect that word with cross. But in Arabic, the word for crusaders, I believe, al-hamalat al-sabayah, which means, you know, the campaign of the cross, and it's got the word cross in it, and it has a very specific Christian significance, and to use that word in that context was catastrophic. And there have been other, certainly other things like that that Bush has done. In fact, there's a piece in this book about that that have had exactly that effect and have been anything but effective. So let me re-speak what I was saying, effective politically, not effective in terms of policy.
Jeff Sundberg, there's a wonderful essay in here called We'll Always Have Kirkuk, where you chronicle the administration's effort to figure out what to call its opponents in Iraq, its violent opponents in Iraq, and that has been a very tough kind of scramble for it to keep up with the evolving perception of what the opposition there is.
Yeah, the original impetus for this was that the L.A. Times city desk, national desk, sent around a memo and said, we don't want to call these people the resistance, because that calls up these images of Humphrey Bogart and the French Casablanca and the French resistance during the war. And they've used just about every word they can. They've used, you see terrorist, you see fedayeen, you see insurgents, which is probably the most neutral word of all. But in a certain sense, the inability to settle on a name for who it is that we're fighting in Iraq is an indication of just how unsure people are about what's really going on there.
And lately it's become thugs and sometimes assassins, thugs, terrorists. It's gotten more and more basic in some way in the presidency.
Right, and you know what's wonderful about those words, I did a piece on that for Fresh Air, which I think was too late for inclusion in this book, but about those two words, thugs and assassins, is that both of them started their life in that part of the world. Thugs were the criminal cults,
a
thuggy that were eradicated after a long and very difficult campaign by the British in the 1830s. Assassin, of course, were literally means hashish eaters, although they probably weren't hashish eaters. That was probably a canard about them. But that word, again, suggests these are words that sort of come from that part of the world and then have worked their way back there.
Right back into the middle of our current politics and our current presidency. Jeff Nunberg, thanks for the book. Thanks for your time, and thanks for your tracking of all things linguistic. It's great having you tonight. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. This was great.
Jeffrey Nunberg, professor of linguistics at Stanford University and author of the new book, Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. In a moment, marking the 50th anniversary of Brown v. Board of Education, this is On Point. Fifty years ago today, the Supreme Court issued a landmark ruling that changed the course of public education and race relations in the United States. In Brown v. Board of Education, the court decided against racially segregated schools. The ruling that separate is inherently unequal signaled the beginning of the end of racial segregation throughout American society, though hardly ended. Earlier today, one of the cities at the center of Brown, Topeka, Kansas, marked the anniversary of Brown with speeches by several notables, including President Bush, his Democratic rival John Kerry, and the head of the Congressional Black Caucus, Representative Elijah Cummings of Maryland. Cummings hailed Brown as a milestone in race relations, but said 5 decades later, America's urban schools are still in crisis. In this excerpt, he reads from a speech an 11-year-old girl gave before Congress last week.
She said, "My name is Carla Kayla Sargent. I am a sixth grade student at John P. Sousa Middle School in Southeast D.C. John P. Sousa is different from other schools in Washington because of its history. Sousa is a historic landmark because it was one of the 5 schools involved in Brown versus Board of Education. Before 1954, black and white children had to attend separate schools. She went on to say the schools that black children went to were unequal to the white schools in terms of physical conditions and educational resources. In 1951, Sousa was a brand new school. It was segregated. It was all white. It had a lot of things that we don't have now. It had clean bathrooms and warm water, windows that could open and close, and a library with a librarian in it. So now they tell us that we cannot have a librarian because the adults say we can't afford the librarian. We can't have a library because the adults say we can't afford a librarian. Listen to what she said. When it was open last year, it only had 1 computer, a lot of very old books. Some of them are the same books that were there in 1951. I don't think that's right, that Sousa can't even have a library like a normal school. Some of the books are ripped and scribbled in. Books that are 50 years old should not be used by students in 2004. She went on to say that Sousa and other public schools in Washington, D.C. are still run down, poor, and dilapidated. This, Kayla said, is not the way it should be 50 years after Brown versus Board. Adults, we must do something about this situation now. That comes from an 11-year-old. Ladies and gentlemen, what she is saying is that while she celebrates Brown, and although she had not even been conceived when Brown came around, she wants to make sure that now that it is her time to learn, that we do everything in our power to make sure that she has the tools to learn and to become all that God meant for her to be. And so it is. This is not a Republican issue versus Democrat. This is not a black, brown, yellow, or white issue. This is a red, white, and blue issue. The fact is, our children are the living messages we send to a future we will never see. We must make sure that we send a powerful message from Topeka, Kansas, as we did 50 years ago. We must send a message so that 50 years from now, when the little Kayla's of the world is 61 years old, she can stand up and say, "They cared about me." But not only did they care, they made sure I got an education so that I could be all that God meant for me to be. May God bless.
Maryland Congressman Elijah Cummings on the 50th anniversary of the Supreme Court's Brown versus Board of Education decision. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.